Welcome to Sensor Noise, a podcast about photography. I'm Andrew, joined as always by my co-host Arthur, whose life I'm going to make hard today because I have a sore throat. So I'm going to be clearing my throat a lot. I'm going to try and remember to mute.
Appreciated.
Yeah. This week we're joined by special guest Victoria Scott, who is the author and photographer of the book We Deserve This, a transfeminine automotive lookbook, which we will be talking about a little bit later. But welcome, Victoria.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you're an automotive writer and photographer.
Yeah.
Not just an automotive photographer, to be clear. But
yeah, no, I can never figure out a way to make that pay the bills, so I had to write about them too.
Right. But what we like to do first here is the news. And of course, the big news in the past couple weeks was that Fujifilm announced a brand new XF lens. Also something about a new camera or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention.
Funnily enough, this actually, they dropped this announcement like 3 hours after we finished recording last time.
I know.
It was we had really, really
very irritating. That's always how it happens. Yeah.
So I have an X100V, the last generation of this. The changes basically between the X100 5 and the X100 6 is the X100 6 has
one better.
Well, yeah, it's one better. It has image stabilization now, which is very nice. And then it also has a higher megapixel sensor. I think it's like 40 something now.
Yeah. Image stabilization 26. Is pretty cool. Although I was reading one of those hot take blog articles that we were talking about before we started recording that was like, not everyone needs image stabilization. They're putting it unnecessarily into cameras. And I'm like, I think it's probably fine.
Oh my God. No, I can shoot in a wider range of scenarios. Yeah. How could you do this to me?
I think, there are people that just want photography to be difficult.
They still make TLRs.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you can go get a 4x5, view camera if you really want to.
I said that and then I realized I don't think they actually do make TLRs, but you can still go buy them.
Yes.
They also added there's a new film simulation to it. So it has Provia, Velvia, Pro, Acros, and then they added Reala Ace as well.
Oh, yeah. So
that's in there too.
I hate that this is like the only thing that Fuji is doing in the film department is it's like, we've added a new film simulate to our digital camera. They're killing me a little bit.
Yeah.
I
got to say though, I almost ordered one. Well, I did order one and then canceled it because.
Oh, did you cancel it?
Yeah. Because I don't know, $1,600 additional dollars just for stabilization.
Have you considered this an article on Petapixel? If you can't get a hold of the X106, you can just fake it with some stickers.
Pretty much.
Some guy has made a little sticker that you can just paste over the top of your X100V that makes it into an X100VI.
Right.
So, there you go. No one will really know the difference. They pretty much look the same. So,
I mean, really, for me, I don't need the 40 megapixel sensor. If I'm going to shoot that high resolution, I might as well use my Nikon. I don't need that out of this.
Mm-hmm.
I do still love the camera, though. If you're thinking about getting one and couldn't get a 5 because of the horrendous availability that they've had, don't hesitate to get one of these. It'll be great.
Yeah. Victoria, have you ever been, enchanted by any of these, fixed lens digital cameras?
Digital, no. I do. So when my book comes out, if it sells well enough, I'm buying myself a Texas Leica. Which nice. Is the Fujica, GW690. Whatever I can get, I don't really care. I just want whatever the 50mm equivalent lens is. I think it's a 90.
Yeah.
It comes with all of them. I just want, I'm going to take it on hikes.
Nice.
That's a good camera. It's also big.
Yeah.
I've seen people use them in real lives, and they are large cameras.
I have, two friends with them now, and every time I see one, I've also used a but it's the G617, so it's the massive panorama camera with the roll cage on it. And just every aspect of interfacing with that, just touching every component feels correct.
That one's neat because I believe the standard case for it is basically a carry-on sized Pelican roller case.
It is, yes.
Because it's just that big.
Yes.
The lens literally has a giant roll cage on it. They've had one at one of the local used camera stores here on the shelf for a while, and I would like it, but boy, is it expensive. And you get like what, 3 shots, maybe 6, something like that.
You get, I think you get 4 on 120 and 8 on 220.
Yeah. But, you know, good luck finding 220 these days.
I have some in my fridge, which is why I want to get a medium for my camera. It's because I currently have, like, I've got, like, 220 rolls of, like, Ektachrome 64 that have been fridge stored since 87 sitting in the fridge. And I'm just like, I need a good camera to put these through instead of wasting them. But anyway, I digress.
See, I'm imagining buying a 617 and then putting, like, a roll of, like, a, you know, $4 Foamapan 200 or something. Be like, yeah, you know, it's whatever. I put some Kent Mirror through it. Speaking of film cameras, Pentax, which has been working on their film camera again since, I guess, the end of 2022, has announced that they're going to be launching it this summer. They've also started an Instagram account for it. And they've been doing the standard photographer Instagram thing of just reposting other people's stories where they're using Pentax cameras. It's not really informative, but you know, it's like, okay, well, I'll follow it anyway. Maybe they'll give me useful information at some point. But yeah, they say it's a fixed lens hand winding compact film camera, so that'll be interesting. Yeah. That sounds like a almost like an Olympus XA type thing.
That maybe. Was literally what I thought too, which would be so nice.
Yeah, that'll be. I mean, this is. Yeah, I'm probably gonna buy this when it comes out. So
of course, we all are.
Yeah,
I mean, you want to show them that this is important and they should do it.
Yeah, I want to show them that they should make a film SLR again because they're all getting pretty old at this point.
It's interesting that in this interview thing, they like mentioned specifically we had to figure out where to get parts and understand how to make film cameras.
Yeah, they had to like bring people back who had retired and been like, how does this work exactly? Can you explain film to me? Yeah.
It's funny. They don't usually mention that stuff.
Yeah. Other exciting news, the Nikon Z9 has been selected as the camera that will fly to the moon for the US's NASA's return to the moon. It's very exciting. Eat your heart out, Hasselblad, I guess. But do you see the pictures in this article about, like, they have it in this little, like, satchel-looking thing. It looks kind of ridiculous.
What's that, like, is that just for dust? Is that what it's
I guess so, yeah. But it's, like, it's just in this, like, little burlap sack-looking thing.
It's like the moon version of the Nikonos.
Yeah, exactly.
and they're suggesting... The viewfinder is covered, so you have to use the LCD.
Yeah.
But in this pouch, it looks like the LCD ends up at a fixed 10-degree angle.
Yeah.
So it's a little tilted, easier to use.
Yeah, it's called the Handheld Universal Lunar Camera, or HULK, because that's, you know, we love doing that sort of thing now, I guess.
Oh my god, NASA loves that. NASA's always loved that. That's not new.
That's true, yeah.
The top comment on this article, it means NASA is not listening to the YouTube and internet shills encouraging.
Does Jared Polin have an opinion about this? He wants a Canon R5 up there or something?
A Sony.
As a member of the Fuji community, I'm very disappointed. I do think it's funny that I think they should send at least one Hasselblad like X2D up there, you know, like probably a $20,000 camera.
I think they should send a film one up, honestly.
Well, that's they should just send an old Hasselblad 500 up. Yeah. And be like, listen, it worked before.
Yeah. Right. So, the next thing is there's a new SD card format, in case you didn't
already. What? Why?
No. This is the question of the moment, is like, how many SD card formats can there be?
This one is called SD Express. And Samsung is the only ones who are making them so far.
Oh, my God.
They're branded Samsung 1TB Pro Plus Micro SD XC1 U3 AQV30.
So what I'm seeing is that on these cards, there's no indication that this is an SD Express card.
Some of them say Express.
Okay. Right. We're reaching Sony levels of like complicated flash storage formats now with SD cards. Because you've got SDHC, XC, and then UC is the new one. And then you have like the different speed ratings, whether it's UHS 1, 2, or 3. And then this is like on top of all of that, there's also this SD Express, which is like a speed rating, but also a completely different way of talking to the card. I don't know. Engineers must be stopped.
Ridiculous too, because these SD Express cards, right? You can buy one of these cards and use it in your existing camera. Right. However, it doesn't support UHS 2. So even though the NAND may be faster, your camera can only talk to it at UHS 1 speeds because it just doesn't do UHS 2. So this thing is useless.
This is like we said in the last episode that like it should just be like an M2 slot that you put an SD or SSD in. Like, stop making this complicated for every photographer ever. I don't want to have to read like 7 different documents to figure out which card is best for my camera. I just want to like go to Micro Center.
This is one of those things. Genuinely though, like this is one of those things where it's like I written my second photography book. I do it professionally for my job. And literally, I realized I had left all of them at home. So I went to Best Buy and bought whatever was $12.
Right.
I mean, maybe if you do video, I guess I get it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for photography, like, is anybody losing sleep over this?
No, but as we've said before, if you're doing video, you buy one of those Atomos Ninja things and plug an SSD into it to record. Like, people aren't recording directly into the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose. That's video. I can barely do stills. Like, come on. images should not be made to move. We fucked up. It's like, oh, shoot. Can I swear?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Fine. All right, good. I should have checked with that first. But like, it's the same thing as making sand think. Images shouldn't move.
Exactly.
We screwed up.
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing. We just keep making sand think faster and faster and making it smaller and smaller to pack more in there.
Right.
You know, it's like, listen, I think that there is something, you know, slightly satanic about having a terabyte the size of my pinky fingernail. You know, that doesn't seem right to me as someone who was born using floppy disks. You know?
A terabyte should be huge. You need a forklift to move a terabyte.
Exactly. One of those giant hard drives they had to unload from 747s or whatever.
It's worth noting that there is not a single device that can use this format at the rated speeds. Card reader. There's no camera. Famously,
so you can buy the card, but you can't actually read it with anything at this.
Well, you can, but only at UHS not at the one speeds.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Also, Samsung phones don't have SD card slots anymore, so you can't even use it in a device produced by Samsung.
Yeah.
I don't know what the point of this is.
Capitalism is the most efficient system of resource allocation.
It's important that we continue to innovate, I guess.
That's right.
We're inventing new forms of flash storage, which are all basically converging around just using PCI Express as the main way of talking
effectively.
To things. And then just putting it in slightly different packages. So
yeah.
I don't know. I think micro SD cards are bad because they're very easy to lose.
Like them at all.
Yeah.
They're too small.
My Nikon ZF uses an SD card and a micro SD card. And like, I just leave the micro SD card in there. I've never taken it out. I don't know. It's just there, I guess, for safety. Like if I forget to put the actual SD card back in, but like, I don't know, you know, why did they do that?
It's the backup one. Like I have two cards in my Z9 and one of them never comes out. It just stays in there.
Yeah.
It's for backup.
Anyway.
OpenAI has created a new horror that it's worth mentioning. this one makes videos.
Every couple months they come out with some sort of new man-made horror beyond comprehension.
Yeah. This one makes weird videos.
This one makes videos, but not well.
No, not particularly well. And because they haven't released any other details about the model other than some like highly curated examples, it's hard to know exactly how this works or does anything.
Did you see the tweet where someone was like, oh, here's what the Lord of the Rings would look like if it had been made by Peter Jackson? if only Peter Jackson had made Lord of the Rings movies. But alas, we have to AI generate them. And now they have like extremely weird color grading and just look wrong. Yeah. No, I saw, I saw some people who I guess had access to this who were doing stuff with it, and like it doesn't, you know, it, because it's an AI and it's just manipulating pixels, it doesn't understand like how objects work. So there was like one of like people moving chairs around, and the chairs are like, you know, moving in weird ways and morphing and whatever as they're moving around. I don't know. It's bizarre. I don't get people who are like, oh, Hollywood has 6 months to live. It's like, no, I think they'll be fine.
I mean, I also think Hollywood was doing this already, regardless of OpenAI. But I think the things that have 6 months to live is probably like advertising agencies. Like, why would I pay an ad agency?
TikTok ads McDonald's are about to get even weirder.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, this, I bet they're going to build something like this into TikTok itself to let you.
What I want, all I want for my TikTok ads, I occasionally get a TikTok ad from this company that just sells like industrial controls equipment.
I love
those. It's just like a photo of a relay or whatever, and it's like, do you need Siemens X3729717? We are industrial equipment supplier, and that's all the ads I ever want to see.
Exactly.
Just a picture of some hyper-specific component.
The ones I've seen of those have they've been advancing, so now they have a 3D model of the object, and it rotates while they say, we're an electronics manufacturer, do you need this Siemens part?
I'm just scrolling through TikTok going, man, I really, really wish I had a very specific PLC component for my factory. Like, oh, dang, how serendipitous. Anyway, there's film news this week. New films. Ferrania has released P33, which is based on a classic post-war cinema stock. Apparently, this one's 160 ISO. They previously had P30, which is like 80 ISO, and they have an orthochromatic one, but that'll be interesting.
Actually new, or is it a respooled something else?
This is, I think it's a new old, you know, like it's an old formula, but it's new. Yeah, it's not respooled anything. What is slightly controversial to me is that Flick Film has announced Aurora 800, a new high-speed fine-grain daylight balanced film that is an 800 ISO color film, and they say it is not a repurposed cinema film or manipulated alternative film stock. And pressing X to doubt.
You sure about that?
where are you getting a brand new 800 ISO film? I'm pretty sure they probably are just getting Kodak to make them something, you know, like, I don't know, this might be the gold 800 that they put in the disposable cameras but don't sell.
Well, you see, they didn't repurpose the film.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we didn't. It's not a re-spooled film because it's just spooled at the factory for us, you know, kind of thing. I don't know.
That's interesting. Weird.
I don't know They say it's cheaper, and they compare it to, like, Portra 800 and Cinestill 800, but it's not. It's still $15 a roll, which is pretty expensive. So, cheaper, for whom? Bad. Call me when it's like $7, you know. Oh
god, yes,
that would be
this
nice.
Is the problem with film.
Oh god, I know.
We'll get into that later. I have some
I say you had an experience.
I did, yeah.
But now I want to talk about Victoria, your new book, We Deserve This, which you've been working on for a couple years now, right?
Yeah, it's been about 2 years and 3 months since I began working on this. Well, 2 years and 4 months since I started working on this, yes.
Because I've been, you know, I guess sort of watching from the sidelines as you've been working on this for the past 2 years, and it has been a labor of love, I think. You've definitely poured your heart and soul into it.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that you don't work on unless you're insane. Because there's no like nobody is clamoring. There's nobody who's like standing there with a giant, you know, there's a giant publishing deal awaiting me because I wrote like the trans feminine automotive lookbook. That's not really a category that's super hot right now. I just did it because I felt like it.
Yeah.
The whole motivating factor was I wish this existed and it doesn't, so I'm gonna make it.
No, but that's good though. But more, we need more things like that, you know. Because I don't know that people were clamoring for it because they didn't know that they wanted it, you know.
I mean, that's the hope. It's I will say that, that the overwhelming response since I began working at it and since I started talking about it more broadly has been very much like there's been a lot of trans femmes who have been like, oh my God, I've always loved cars. Thank you for, you know, feminizing. Thank you for showing me a feminine way to engage with this hobby I already loved because it's so stereotypically masculine in so many people's minds. Mm-hmm. And then there's been a lot of people who are like, this is just cool from a fashion perspective. This is cool from an empowerment perspective. You know, it's kind of a empowering take on traditional, like, I don't know, those tacky calendars you see at the mechanic shop with a bunch of old dudes paint smoking Marlboro Reds where they got like bikini girls on 57 Chevys. Right. It's like, what if that yeah. wasn't terribly sexist and kind of cool?
Yeah. What if it wasn't, you know, women with like extreme spray tans and American flag bikinis on top of 70s muscle cars, but was instead, you know, people with interesting cars.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also like, you know, the titling We Deserve This is like, it is for our gays. You know, this is it. I think that's part of the reason that it probably won't be as commercially successful as if I had shot it in a different way, because I want cis people to enjoy it. I would like people to appreciate it for the effort that's gone into the photography and for, you know, all of the models, all of what they brought to it. But it's ultimately by a trans woman with a bunch of other trans women for trans women. You know, that's really kind of the crux of this is like, I wanted something for our community to look at and have a positive example of this is what us being happy and successful and excited about that looks like.
That's a good enough reason. You don't need more of a reason than that. I mean, like, it's honestly, it's pretty amazing that you can just make this book happen. We've talked in the past about how difficult it is to, like, actually make a photo book. And this is more involved than any of the things that I've done or Andrew's done.
Yeah.
To just make this.
It's been challenging. I mean, my publisher, Ryan from Carrera Books, is been helpful with all the logistics as far as printing and, you know, ordering and stuff goes. And we did. So I last winter in January of 2023, I released a book called Postcards from the End of the World. And that was a sort of a fictional post-apocalyptic horror story where I had about 45 pictures in it that I had taken through the American West, rural Idaho, all the way to the coast of California at Point Reyes National Seashore. And that was, you know, I wrote a story on postcards to accompany it. And so that way it was kind of a weird experimental project. It was printed as a 4x6 photo book only. And we did like a very limited run of it. And that was sort of to test how this would go. This book was kind of the big project that I knew I was working towards. And I really wanted to be successful and gorgeous and, you know, go off without a hitch. So we did that first. And like, that was instructive. I learned a lot. I got my ass kicked with that release. It was hard as hell. You know, it was a more effort than I've ever put into anything for the least amount of money ever. And it was completely worth it. I'm really happy with how it came out. And the people who got it really liked it. Mm-hmm. So this one, I'm hoping that we'll use the lessons from that, which is a much smaller, you know, less ambitious scope to kind of make this one perfect. But it's tricky.
Yeah. 21 shoots in 4 states over the course of 2 years is what the copy on the
I think it was there. I think it was 7 or 8 different cities. It was Michigan, Texas, California, and Washington. And I did like LA and SF in California and Dallas and Austin in Texas, Detroit, and then a bunch of areas, kind of like the greater Cascadia region, because we went all the way out to Rainier for a few of them. We went all the way to the Cascades. So but yeah, that's roughly the scope of it.
And a true, I guess, you know, I like this because this is the era of cars mostly that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in like a 50s Edsel, but you know, you got like a GTI here and a Focus RS. Is this an Ariel Atom?
That is a, I know which one you're talking about. It's a really crazy looking, like sort of F1-ish looking vehicle.
Yeah,
that is a BAC Mono R.
Oh, yeah. That would have been my second guess.
Yeah, the Atom, I know the Atom's 3-wheeled, isn't it?
No, the Atom is 4-wheeled, but it's got the like external roll cage kind of looking structure to it.
Yeah, yeah.
The Morgan is 3-wheeled.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that one is so much of this book came together too, because like all of the models in it are mostly my friends. Some of them I connected with specifically for shooting the book. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was very much, I didn't have a budget. I basically would go to cities for press trips for my main day job, or I'd be there, you know, traveling around the country. and I'd get a shoot done. And getting cars, you know, about half the cars in the book were the people who were modeling. It's their car. Yeah. About the other half, it was, you know, give me a vibe. Give me kind of the style you want to dress in. And I'll try to match it. I'll try to find a car that sort of suits that kind of character. And if you have like a favorite car, let me know. And so much of this kind of ended up verging on sort of I know a guy. And the BAC Mono R was the pinnacle of I know a guy. There are none besides that one in the U.S. that have a license plate on it.
I was going to say, as I'm aware. Yeah.
How do you go about finding, like you said, a lot of these people are your friends, but like the ones that weren't, how do you find models like this to do this for you?
I got lucky, and a lot of this book I worked on before Twitter became a cesspool. So, and I had a very big following, and because of like, so my day job is, you know, I write about cars, so I have a big automotive audience, and I have access to a lot of people and resources at OEMs, at car manufacturers.
Sure.
And then through my Twitter following, you know, I spoke a lot about trans issues and a lot about queer rights. And so I had a lot of, you know, LGBT sort of community resources. And then a lot of it was also, you know, I met a guy at a car show a couple years ago that knew a lady who owned a Porsche 911S, and she was down to model for the book, you know, and so he connected the two of us. And it was very much kind of just like a leveraging whatever connections I had possible to just meet as many people as broadly as I could. And there were people in it who, like, I talked to a handful of times before we shot. We ended up hitting it off, and now we're still friends. There are people who I've become friends with, even though they weren't in the book, but we met because of the book. My current roommate, actually, reached out to me because she wanted to be in the book. We couldn't make it happen before I finished all the photography, but, like, we still live together and are, like, besties. So it was, like, a very positive thing to kind of branch out and get to meet all these people.
Oh, nice.
Is Char's Oldsmobile Delta 88 diesel in the book?
It is not. Unfortunately, she is not in the book. We weren't able to get that to work. She had not bought it until I was finished with photography.
That's a hell of a car.
I did review that for my day job, actually.
Yeah. One of the original diesels with all the baggage that entails.
Yeah, I just wrote a story for Motor One about how I called it the worst. I said the article's title was The First Drive, The Worst Car in America.
Yeah, I don't understand how it's still operable, really. Like, how is it not just a pile of junk?
They were better by 81. Genuine answer. They had fixed a lot of the initial issues. The person who owned it was absolutely like that type of guy who's just like, this is my car and I'm going to keep it forever. And then like Charlotte, which if you've met Charlotte, that's self-explanatory. For those of you that don't know Charlotte, imagine the kind of person who sole operable vehicle is a 1981 Oldsmobile diesel, and you will understand what it is like to know Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is an endorsement.
You just reviewed this. Yes.
This past week. Yes. Yeah. I've written a bunch of other stuff about it before, but this was the first time I actually like sat down and wrote 1200, 1300 words, whatever, about specifically all of the different boondoggles of this design. And I shot it, which was fun.
Mm-hmm.
So for this book, are all these film photos?
No, these are all digital.
Okay.
So this is all shot on my Nikon D750 with whatever lenses I had on me at the time. And there is no artificial lighting in it whatsoever because I traveled so much.
Okay, that's impressive.
Well, and I'm super cheap, right? So I don't want to pay for like checking a bag. So everything has to fit in the carry-on.
Okay, so how did you... This photo of Zan at the very bottom with the GTI.
Okay, that one is... I should say, that one does have... One of my friends had an LED panel at her house.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And she brought that with us. We didn't use flashes, I should say.
I don't think you can get the bisexual lighting just naturally. You know,
well, actually, really so in a couple of those shots, we used a nearby traffic light for some of the illumination.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was LED panels because I had I was staying at a friend's place in Detroit and she had a couple of them. And I was like, yeah, bring them. They were battery powered, whatever, but it was enough to get like cool accent lights.
Yeah. Yeah. I love some RGB LEDs. Those are very fun. I have some of the like wands that I, you know, take around to things.
Yeah.
It's fun. They're just fun little things.
Oh yeah.
It's such a good picture though, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's very
I don't, you know, I would screw it up cause the headlights are on the car and like how that's not just blowing out the image. I don't understand, I guess.
Raw.
You know.
Shoot raw, Andrew. That's how.
Well, this is like, how the heck do you take good pictures of cars anyway? Like, setting aside that you also have models in these photos, which is, you know, I'm assuming adding an additional layer of difficulty, but like, I don't know. I don't, like, I've gone to Cars and Coffees, and I just don't feel like I know what I'm doing. It might just be because the cars there are kind of boring, you know.
I think, wow, Camaro. I definitely think that that's part of it. I've shot a lot of Cars and Coffees, and getting stuff that's interesting out of it is really challenging. Because everything is just like, it's a car in a parking spot, right? Like, that's not super interesting as a subject. You have to think of the car as, like, it should be a poseable model too. And that's when you can start having fun with it. You know, what you think about is kind of like, how is the light going to hit the haunches of this car? If you understand like car design, you understand like what your character lines are. You can choose to try to illuminate those specifically. If you look at kind of the cover of this book, the way that that gold car is lit, it's there's an emphasis kind of on like the inherent like curvy sidelines of the car. And so like, once you start thinking of it in terms of any other three-dimensional object you can pose, in terms of how is this going to look in this kind of lighting, that I think helps a lot. I also tend to shoot things very, I don't know, studio-like, even in the world. So, you know, the car has separation from the things around it, and I think that that's like lends itself well to automotive photography. If you do like really good city photography, which is very hard for me, that doesn't lend itself well to car photography, I feel like.
No, because, it's not.
Because it's like, what you're looking there for there is kind of like you're pinpricking meaning out of just random chaos, right? And with automotive photography, it should be, you know, the entire scene should just build to the object you featured. That's kind of how I look at it, at least. So, which is very different than like the chaos of a city or a streetscape or whatever.
No, I mean, I agree. That's like, I do aviation photography and I look at it the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, how many 737s have you seen in your life? It's difficult to make them interesting.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to frame them in a way where there's two approaches that I take. One is, you know, catch it doing something interesting, frame it so that, like you said, the whole scene builds to the thing that you're focusing, or pick an aspect of it to kind of make it an abstract art almost. Yep. Like find a curve that's interesting to take a picture of.
Yeah. Something like that. Absolutely. So like that's good. And then there's like technical tips too, like, you know, carry a polarizer. They're great for cars. You know, it's try to make sure the car is cleanish. It doesn't actually matter all that much. Everybody's like, oh, the car's gonna be waxed. And it's like, no, the car can be dirty. It's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I just think of it like most other objects. And I think the other thing too is like there's a bit of, you know, what kind of what you speak to there, Arthur, about like the detail stuff. So much of shooting a car with a model is trying to figure out how to get a good shot of the model just, you know, by herself.
Yeah.
Right.
With some sort of detail on the car that stands out and differentiates it from other cars. So there's shots of like Zan with that Golf. That's an R32. And there's like a shot of them with, you know, the badge right behind, like little, you know, R32 badge right behind them. Just like lit just out of focus behind them. And like, that's a cool thing. You know, it's difficult to kind of incorporate both without sort of hinting at it. So I don't know.
Yeah. I'm looking back on some of the Cars and Coffees pictures that I've taken. I think part of the problem is because they're like stuffed into a parking lot. You have all the cars like parked next to each other. There's basically no way to like maneuver around the car and get anything other than like a front or back photo that, you know, has any, it isn't blocked by eight other cars.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool the same thing as like you can't do like good portraits in a crowded shopping mall, right? You have to take a different kind of photo there. So,
yeah, there's a DMC 12 at this one though. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yep, there's a that late. She actually owns that car.
Oh wow,
that was a childhood dream car of hers, and she decided she would buy one, and then she bought two. As is the case, because she had one broken one, and she was like, well, if I buy a second broken one, I can make a one working one out of it. And she did. But, you know, she's got two of them now. She might actually have three since the last time I saw her. I'm not sure.
This is my philosophy with Praktika film cameras. It's like, I got one, it didn't work. I bought a second one, it worked for a bit and then quit working. And now I have a third one, which kind of works.
Yeah.
It's the sunk cost fallacy here, Andrew.
Yeah.
You just keep getting more. Surely one of them will work one day.
Right. That's, yeah, exactly. I just have to, like, subscribe to, like, a monthly subscription where a German guy sends me cameras, you know? Just send me a new camera every month. New East German camera.
Hi, Sharks. I'm here to sell you East German camera boxes.
You know, the target market may be small, but it's fervent.
So what, Victoria, what got you into photography in the first place?
So I think the earliest idea of it came into me, like the earliest inspiration was when I was 11 or 12 years old. I was really into meteorology because I was a normal child with friends.
Yeah.
And I And I was like 100%. Documenting cloud structures with my parents' Sony CyberShot. Mm. And I realized at a certain point that I was like no longer super interested in meteorology, but I really liked the process of taking pictures. And so they had an old Minolta Maxim, like whatever the cheapest SLR was you could have.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot
a Maxim 3.
Yeah. And this is when you could go get film developed at Target.
Right.
Right.
So I would shoot rolls and, you know, I'd experiment with stuff, and this is before I had any idea of like how to push or pull film, or like, you know, the camera was mostly set to aperture priority and I was messing around a little bit, and I was probably like, I don't know, 13 or 14 at this point. And I realized that, you know, this was as film stocks were starting to fall off the shelf. There was no really good like resources for it at this point that I remember, and I was homeschooled, so there wasn't like I had teachers to help with this. This was just me being interested,
right?
So I decided that I needed a digital camera because I wanted to do like sports photography, because my brother played hockey and I really wanted to like get higher speed shots that, you know, you couldn't get with an 800 speed film indoors in a hockey rink. Mm-hmm. So my parents got me a D3100 for Christmas one year. I think I was like probably 15 or 16. And it was like, you know, so I could take pictures of my brother playing hockey. And I did that for quite a while. I did hockey tournament photography. I would set up a folding plastic table and I had like a decent Canon photo printer, and I would go shoot for 45 minutes, upload all the pictures, talk with parents for 20 minutes, and I'd be out shooting the next game right after that. Like my dad would sit there with the computer, but it was mostly a one person operation. So I did that for a while. I just used to shoot anime conventions. I did senior portraits for a bunch of my friends. I did like a lot of, I would go to car meets and I'd shoot stuff and I'd tell people like, oh, you can hire me or whatever. And I'd shoot, you know, put photos of people's cars. So I just kind of did whatever I could with it for a long time. And the whole reason I'm a writer actually is that I don't know if you ever read Speed Hunters.
No.
Okay. Okay. So in the like mid teens, Speed Hunters was kind of just like the site for Japanese car culture. And I've always liked cars, and they hired a lot of very good photographers. Larry Chen started his career there. And Larry Chen is a very, very good motorsports photographer and automotive photographer. He's phenomenally talented. But so, you know, I'm probably 18 at this point, maybe a little older, reading, you know, these articles about all these cool cars, with these beautiful, like, you know, magazine style spreads with them. And so when I first got a car and I first started going to car meets, I started writing little articles to accompany my photos in the style of Speed Hunters, because I wanted to emulate their whole like cool photography style. And that was kind of how I started writing more. So yeah, that was kind of the whole background to it. And then I just kind of did it on and off for a while. And I just started doing this because there's a lady I know who is very beautiful on camera. She's on the cover of this book. She is just like, I've never seen a bad photo of her. She's just one of those people you just aim a camera in her vicinity and the light just cooperates and everything falls into place. And she's always dressed in a way that is just like so like effortlessly stylish. And
previous guest on this program.
Yes.
We won't tell Claire you said.
Yeah. She has no idea that I think any of this about her, of course.
No, not at all.
But I went to go visit her, and I had borrowed that gold car that's on the cover.
Is that an MR2?
Yes, it is. It is a JDM MR2.
Oh, wow.
It was imported from a friend of mine. So when I used to own a Japanese van, I had it at his shop for some repairs, and he gave me that car as a loaner while I had it in his shop, which was the coolest loaner of all time. 5-speed manual, For those of you who are car enthusiasts, a Beam 3 SGE. It was a fifth revision MR2. So it was basically the pinnacle of that car. Like, it never got better. We never got them in the US. It was just a Japanese version. It was so good. And so we had this car. We had a couple of hours to kill until we had dinner. And we were like, why don't we just do pictures? And we did. And I just was like so struck with how well they came out. Because, like, again, you know, Claire is just amazingly fun to take photos of. And we had this gorgeous car. And we were like right in front of it. This is in Dallas. So that the train that's blurred on the cover is the dark train. And it was this like beautiful striking shade of yellow that just like, it was just these pictures that you're like, I have to do something with this, right? Like this is, if I take this inspiration, I do nothing with it. That is a waste. Yeah. So that was kind of like where it started. Anyway, sorry. I know that's a little bit off topic, but
no, just, no, all good.
Yeah.
I remember seeing those photos and being like, wow.
Yeah. No, I very rarely, like, I try to be pretty critical of my work because I don't want to just like, you know, huff my own farts and be like, oh, I'm so good at this. And, you know, there's a lot of improvement in a lot of it. But that was a set that I sat back and I was like, whoa, this is really good. So I did that. And then the next shoot was a friend of mine who is also a photographer. We met up when I had another loaner car from that guy. It was a black Toyota Supra. And we did a shoot together to see if I could do it again. I was like, if I can replicate this success, then I should do a series. And so we did it.
Pull a rabbit out of a hat a second time.
Yes, and we did it. And so I was like, okay, this has got to be, you know, I bounced around kind of like, should I do like this cool like little PDF thing? Should I do like a bunch of like, you know, like wallpaper-esque spreads? And then I decided this was kind of around the time, I mean, it's always been kind of the time like this, where it's like, it's been rough for the queer community. It's been rough for trans people. It's been rough for trans femmes, right? Like, there, we do live in an era where our rights are slowly getting rolled back. I've lived in three different states since I started shooting this book because I've never been able to settle down. Four states. Jesus. I started in Texas. I went to Nevada. I went to Idaho. Now I'm in Washington, which is much better. But you know, I was living in relatively hostile places and I felt kind of this like, part of what I enjoy about photography is that it is a documentation of the things you bear witness to, right? Like it is a record of one's life. Yep. It is a record of one's loved ones. It is a record of ways of existence. And so part of the reason that I made it initially was because I was so stressed from living in what felt like just constant threat where, you know, I knew every day wasn't necessarily a given and I didn't know what was going to come next. I didn't know how elections were going to go. I didn't know what rights I would wake up to the next day that were going to be gone. That I was like, I have to feel like I'm contributing something to the record of what it was like to be here and now. You know, I have done a bunch of advocacy work. I've done a bunch of charity work. I've done a bunch of public awareness stuff, you know, kind of, I've written things for Insider, trying to like beg cis people basically to pay attention. And, you know, I've had mixed success. But I was like, I want something that is uplifting. I need something uplifting. I want this, you know, we all need it, but like, I want to see something in the world that reminds me, no matter what happens, that there was this moment that was very good and all of my friends were here and, you know, we all lived it, you know, and that can be morbid or it can be uplifting depending on how you look at it. And I chose to look at it uplifting. And so that was kind of, that was like the guiding, that was when it got called We Deserve This and I haven't changed it since then.
I really like that. I think it's uplifting. I don't think it's morbid at all. I mean,
I think it's definitely uplifting. I'm so happy with how it came out. The only part that's been kind of sad for me is there is a lady in the book. Her name is Lauren. I met her because of the book, so I didn't know her before we started shooting. I was out in Berkeley, and she had a blue 911S that she had owned since 1985. She raced it, she modified it, she came out in about 2003 and basically annihilated her whole life doing so, which is a pretty common thing for trans people, right? Like, you know, she had divorced, you know, she was 40 at the time, 2003 or 2002, something like that. She was like right around 40 and she was like, she sold her house. She, you know, basically was like, I'm starting my whole life over. The only thing she kept was this Porsche, this blue 911S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I met up with her. It was 2020. Was it 2021 or two? I think it may have been early. It was early 2022. We met up And I shot her with her car. We talked for a while, and she was in her 60s, and so she was like, she'd been out for 20 something years, you know, had been successful and happy and like rebuilt her life, and you know, still had this really cool car that she still was very passionate about. And was like very, she was fantastic. And unfortunately, she passed away before I could finish this, which I'm kind of bummed about. Cause I really, she was so excited about it. And I really was just like, I don't know. She was very helpful to me in a lot of ways, because there's not a lot of healthy examples of like how to live
right.
as a trans woman. There's just not, we don't, the successful elders go stealth and the inspiring ones are dead. Like there's just not a great model for it. So like to meet her, somebody who was still proud and out well after she had to be, was so inspiring. And so she helped me a ton. And so I kind of wish that she could have seen it, because I really wanted to be like, I sent her pages first. And she did really like them, but I just, you know, that's the only part of it that's like sad for me.
She is immortalized in the book.
It's dedicated to her. I 100% dedicated it to her. So, but that's the only part of it where I'm like, damn, that's kind of upsetting, because she was really cool. But
like you said, that's the point of it. I mean,
I know you've
documented these moments in time, for forever. Regardless of what happens, happened, it's still here.
Well, and that's part of why I'm so intent on this being distributed via print.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, one of the debates I had early on was it's so much easier to do PDF books. I've done online ebooks and stuff, and it's much easier. You have much more flexibility with the format. It's way easier to do logistics. You don't have to worry about it, like nearly as much stuff. You can just shoot the photos, design it, and then it's done. But the problem with that is, you know, I'm very sensitive to like how media survives. You know, it's very easy for things on the internet to go away. And, you know, I think a lot about how like, you know, the first book burnings in the 30s in Berlin, when the Nazis took over, were mostly stories and articles and records about trans people. You know, that was like literally what they went for first.
Right.
And so part of the motivation for this as a physical book is like, this is a record of all of us, and it's going to be shipped to as many countries as I can send it to. You know, this will be on 3 or 4 continents, probably, I think, just based on pre-orders alone, when it's sent out. And I like that idea a lot.
I do too.
Yeah. The other thing I like about it is that everyone in it is supremely confident. You know, which I know is not a experience that trans femmes always have. So
yeah. Yeah, no, I think a lot of it, I think that's what makes the book work, is that that was the main thing, right? It's like, I didn't care how cool the cars were, really. I didn't really care what environment, like, we shot a couple of these. Like, there's 2 shoots in here where we didn't abandon parking lots in, like, East Hollywood. Like, you know, they ended up being super cool. Like, there's one shoot that's a brand new bright blue Acura NSX in front of an abandoned movie theater, with like a friend of mine who dressed in like, you know, leather collar, ripped jeans, battle jacket. It's super cool. But like, it wasn't anything like super fancy or whatever, you know. It was just kind of like, we have this location. The main goal of all of this was, I want everybody to represent themselves exactly how they want. I want them to, you know, everybody gets a quote in the book that's kind of about their personal style or their ethos or their journey with transition or their take on car culture or whatever they want. They all dress themselves however they want. You know, this wasn't like can we have more designer stuff? It was literally just like, tell me how you want to look and feel as confident as you can when you walk up, and I will gas you up the rest of the way there. And we will, like, this is just about you. So yeah, I hope it worked. I honestly think it did.
Well, and it's a delightful experience, you know, because I've taken photos of people and shown them to them, and they're like, you know, wow, I look like that. And that's just it's a really good feeling to be able to imbue someone with that confidence. You know, I even get it when people take pictures of me, because I don't think I'm particularly photogenic, but people manage to take decent photos of me. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good feeling. I mean, I did one of the projects I did before I moved to Seattle. I was living in rural Idaho, and I was alone like all of the time. My partner at the time was a pilot, and so was gone for 2 weeks at every month. And so I was just by myself in extremely, like, painfully rural Idaho, 2.5 hours from an airport, 2 hours from a freeway. I mean, like, really, truly in the middle of nowhere.
And it sounds like the average Idaho experience.
Yeah, if you don't live in Boise, you live here, basically. It was a town called Salmon, for those of you that are curious. It is off of US 93. It's very pretty. There's a very good bakery.
Were there natural salmon there?
No, white people killed all of them.
Nice. Mm.
So there used to be, but, you know. There was also the Sacagawea Center there, but there was absolutely no native people for like several, like 100 miles. Also,
that sounds about right.
White people. Yeah. So just one of those places where you're kind of like, oh, interesting. Anyway. So I lived there for a while and I was bored out of my skull and I did a self-portrait project. I did like a little ebook thing. It was like, self-portraits from my past lives, and I'd dress in Victorian clothing and go to ghost towns and do self-portraits. And even that was like kind of a confidence builder. I felt a lot better after that, honestly.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, it was. Portraits are fun. I don't know. I feel better after I get them taken. Sometimes people shoot me on film, and I'm always just like, oh my god, I could kiss you.
I get some good portraits of my friends when we're, you know, at events or whatever, but I don't have a lot of portrait practice with models like Andrew does. The photography and art scene here in the San Francisco area is bad. There's not a lot of others like me.
And somehow it's somehow good here in,
yeah,
in Central Ohio. I don't really understand it, but I'm not complaining. Yeah, if you're interested in getting hold of this book, you can pre-order it at Carrara Books. We'll have the link in the show notes. And then, Victoria, you've got a Patreon as well where you post photos.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, we'll link that too.
We'll link that as well.
Thank you. Yeah, the next post is what I've been doing lately is I used to do daily photos. And what I've been doing lately is every time I get a roll developed, I have been trying to use a different film stock every time. And then I like post my favorites and do notes on it. So. Hmm. I've been trying to do those like, you know, once a week or something. It's inconsistent, but you know.
Your Patreon cover photo goes so hard. The Camry.
Thank you. Yeah, that was we had wildfire smoke roll in and I was like, well, I can either get sad that I can't breathe or I can use this for a cool picture.
This is what I want to do more of, which is like, you know, like a themed shoot. Because this is like, this gives me like a post-apocalyptic kind of vibe, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I had the idea the other day that I wanted to do like a Blade Runner type shoot, you know, with like lots of low key lighting, but colorful. And, you know, I don't know.
Oh, hell yes.
Like a theme song I want to do with it kind of thing. So
themed shoots are so cool because they require you to strip down exactly what you think makes up an aesthetic.
Right.
And then emphasize it. And so like it's made me think so much more carefully about like how I perceive media. It's so much fun. I recommend it so much.
Yeah, I have a friend Mel who is doing a project exploring masculinity, and I was one of the models for it. And the theme that she told me that I should dress up as was 90s lover boy, and I was like, what is that even like? I have to, you know, I have to go to the Gap and buy some weird jeans. But it turned out great, you know. I'm in like, you know, faded, slightly baggy jeans and like this like lightly colored long sleeve shirt. And then she had like a bunch of like hearts behind me. And she had like a headband, like a Valentine's Day headband that had little hearts on like springs flopping around that she had me wear. spaced like chocolates around me. It was very interesting.
It's what Drake thinks he is. You could have just modeled after him.
Yeah, basically. So yeah, I want to do more of that. Now that I feel like I've built my skills actually photographing people that I can now do like themed work with that, you know, because I used to, I was afraid of taking pictures of people. I would only take pictures of things, landscapes, buildings, and so on. And then started going with these photography groups on photo walks or whatever. And you know, there are models who come along who just pose for us, which is very nice, and they're very good. And it's like, oh, okay, I actually like taking pictures of people. It's a lot of fun, you know. You can put them in all sorts of strange places, you know, like down a tiny, like 2 foot wide alleyway between a building, you know, or sitting on a chair, you know, under a culvert, you know, surrounded by nothing, or sitting on the loading dock of an old Italian restaurant that's been closed for a year.
You know, if you want a place to go that's perfect for this, might I suggest the Walt Disney World?
Mm.
That's where I, like, honestly, that's where I learned most of what I know was after college. We went to Disney in 2018, 2019, 2020, like every other month. Mm. And I took so many pictures. And that is a perfect area to experiment with that stuff, because like everything is pristine and there's tons of different environments to pose people in for portraits.
Yeah. Just having someone pose in front of a wall that's painted Galway green or whatever.
Yeah. The purple wall outside of Spaceship Earth, in front of Spaceship Earth,
yeah.
Behind Spaceship Earth, you know, the classic locations.
Well, I think the other thing too, that's like, that's just part of why I like cars, right? It's like they're instant theme.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know, it's like
they're a good crop. Yeah.
I got like I have a 90s Toyota. Cool. Let's do like, you know, 90s hip photographer girl. Like Claire, you know, brought her Polaroid with us and it was like, cool, we have an entire vibe.
Right.
With two carefully chosen things, a very expensive and hard to find sports car and a Polaroid camera. we've made our own vibe. It was just that easy.
Yeah.
Was it an expensive Polaroid camera or a cheap one?
I think all Polaroid is expensive, isn't it? Isn't it like more expensive than gold by weight or something?
Right. Well, I think Claire has a Polaroid now, which is one of the newer ones. Mm. So there.
Yeah, it's a newer one. It's yellow, which is what's important.
Right. This is an attempt at a segue to your Instax Wide that you've purchased, Andrew.
Oh yeah, I bought a Fuji Instax Wide camera.
Well, thank God you didn't buy a square.
Yeah, you know. Well, so I one of the camera stores near me got a great deal on a ton of Instax Wide film that's like short dated, so it's on sale for like $8 a pack, which is an incredible deal.
Yeah, I'll say.
And Instax Wide is, in my opinion, the best currently available instant camera format and the largest, unless you happen to have stuff to do Polaroid 8x10, but good luck with that. and so they had the cameras there and they weren't too expensive. And I was like, you know what? I've been thinking about getting one of these for a long time and this seems like a good opportunity. So I did it. I bought an Instax Wide 300 and like 4 packs of film.
Does the Instax Wide 300 have any features?
No.
That's good. I mean, that's what you want.
What the traditional Fujifilm instant experience.
No, I mean, Fuji, they've been shoving
the photo.
They've been shoving a bunch of digital stuff into their
regular Instax. No, this is pre all of that nonsense. Yeah.
Okay. I have go ahead.
The features that it has includes a clip-on close-up lens with a selfie mirror, which is literally just a plastic lens, and then it has a button that turns the flash on, and then a button that either lightens or darkens the exposure.
Hey, that's two more buttons than I've got on mine.
Oh, okay.
I have an SQ1.
For buttons.
I have an SQ1, which is a blue piece of plastic that I wish I could. It's the drill tweet about toilets.
Yeah.
I wish I could kick it in against the wall and shatter it into 1,000 porcelain pieces, but I need it. That's how I feel about the SQ1. I hate that camera with a burning passion, but it's my only instant camera, and I love instant photos.
Yeah. We might have to upgrade you to an SQ40.
I would literally kill for anything that's got a flash on or flash off button, because the SQ1 does not have that. It just always has the flash on. And so it's kind of just like the picture might come out well, or maybe it won't. The only person, again, the only person who get consistent results out of that camera that I've ever met is Claire.
Yeah.
Because she just like, she knows how to work light. I don't know. She's like, her quote in the book is like, something about being a goddess of light, and I thought it was a joke at the time, and I don't think it is anymore.
If she can make this camera work.
Yeah, it's just, it's not, I hate that thing. And I also love it. It's, again, thrill toilet tweet.
Well, you can spend a whole bunch of money on one of those mint cameras, the SLR ones that shoot Instax or whatever. Or what's the other ones? The Nons, that EF mount lenses that we talked about?
The fucked up thing is I thought about that for a little bit, and I was like, no. But what's more likely is that I'll end up doing is I'll probably get like a Mamiya something and get an Instax back for it.
Yes, I know a couple of people who have that, and that is, I think, a good way to go. Yeah, there's also like the Lomography's Lomo Instant. They have some of them that have glass lenses, which I think would probably be decent, but yeah, I don't know.
I feel like I've got a couple of pictures of me taken on a Mamiya. Like it's an Instax Square photo taken on a Mamiya, and it is like gorgeous. Like the film is unbelievable. It is. Yeah. It has, you know, absolutely no range whatsoever. But if you nail the exposure, it is just gorgeous.
Yeah, I have.
It's just bad that the lenses and the cameras and everything around them sucks.
I know. Yeah, and also it's the only like analog photography stuff that Fuji is still actively doing anything with. Because there was that news last year that's like Fuji's expanding its film production, and it's like it's Instax film production. It's like no, come on.
I'm seeing. I know we made fun of Nons before, but they do have a product that I want, which is for $279. They have an Instax Square film back for Hasselblad 500 series.
Okay.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
So,
all right. Well, when I sell my kidney, I'll consider that.
Yeah.
I'm strongly considering trying to find an old waist level one, like with the waist level box, and then maybe eventually being able to buy the digital back for it. But this Instax back would be pretty neat.
So I have my main film camera is a Nikon F100, but since I have learned that the Nikon F5, which is like the fancier version, can be equipped with a waist level finder, I'm now obsessed with that in my mind. But
oh, that's pretty cool, actually.
I mean, imagine an Nikon F5, but you're holding it at waist level. Like, that's, I guess, you know, I desire
I'm to rotating this in my mind palace, and it's pretty right, cool.
Exactly.
It was cool. Like, those, the F5, and I think the F6 as well, had the interchangeable
F6 viewfinders. Doesn't, which is the thing.
No?
F4 and F5 do, but the F6 doesn't.
Yeah, I wish they hadn't given up on that. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
yeah.
They just gave up.
Yeah. I have a really nice Instax wide photo that was taken of me with the Lomo apparat back for 4x5 cameras. So it was taken on a view camera, but then, you know, on Instax wide. And so it's really sharp. It's like, I didn't know instant photos could be this good. That's something I also want too, is like, what if I just bought, I was looking, you know, a couple months ago into like, what does it take to do the Polaroid 8x10 stuff? And, the answer is a lot of money and a lot of old equipment.
One of the coolest photos I've ever had taken of me is a Polaroid 8x10.
I was going to say,
I have one. Yeah. One photo from Carter. We set it up in a friend's living room. And it took about 30 minutes to get everything kind of set up right. And then, you know, it takes 45 minutes for the photo to actually come out. And you have to run it through like a pancake squeezer press.
Right, yeah. You have to put it through this whole apparatus to squeeze it.
It's the most impractical. It really was like, I get why people used to be so excited to get their pictures taken when it was daguerreotypes. Because it's like, oh, it's the contraption.
Right. Well, it's the contraption, and then it's a Polaroid that's 8 inches by 10 inches big. It's huge, you know?
Yeah, and it was super cool. I love that picture of me, like, to death.
Yeah. Speaking of film cameras, Arthur, you have news. You surprised me with this.
I finally have gone and gotten myself some film camera.
Well, because you had to go out, and you're like, I have to go someplace, but it's right next to San Jose.
Yeah, I had to go. I had to go pick up some dress shirts from the dress shirt store.
Yeah,
and that's right next to
videotapes, kind of thing.
Yeah. That's right next to the San Jose camera store. Yeah. And so I went in. I was looking.
That's for how a they plena. Get you.
I was looking for a plena, to be honest, and they didn't have any of those. Yeah. But they had this kit for $299, they had this kit that was a Nikon 8008S and what is it, a 20mm 2.8 lens and a 35-70 2.8 and a flash for $300. I said,
and I said, that's a, I think I said, that's a pretty spectacular deal.
Yeah, it's a pretty good deal. So I picked, I got that. I've tried it out. It works great.
The Nikon 8008S or the Nikon boobs, as I'd like to think about it.
I don't know why they gave it that name in the US.
It's, I don't know. Cause in, yeah, cause in other countries, it was the F801, which is, yeah. That was before. I think the F100 is where they were like, you know what, we're just not going to have different names for these.
Yeah.
A lesson that Canon still has not learned.
They sure have not.
But so, yeah, what films did you get?
Got two rolls of Kodak Gold, just, you know, normal Kodak.
Standard
I
classic.
What did I get? I put it in the
You didn't get Phoenix. So you said they didn't have
Phoenix. No, they didn't have Phoenix, which is too bad.
Yeah.
I got Ektar and I got another Fuji one. I don't remember which one though.
I know Victoria's an Ektar enjoyer. Of course,
I love Ektar. Well. I was about to, but the thing is, like, I know this is probably unpopular, but I can't stand Phoenix.
Really?
Oh my God.
I just want to try it.
Yeah.
I had the same like gut impulse of like, oh, well, I should try it. It's new. It's cool. It's not. Don't try it. It's not worth it. just shoot anything else in the like buy yourself a roll of Color Plus 200 for half the price or what, you know, Kodak Gold 200, whatever the hell it is. Yeah, some reasonable thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then enjoy having good photos instead of bad ones.
Yeah.
You'll feel so much better about it.
but what if I want my photos to be deliberately bad?
There's a friend in my local friend group who is probably going to listen to this, and we argue about this every single time we talk about it. And it's literally just comes down to like, do you want the photos to be good or bad? And I simply am somebody who, you know, I think I want my photos to be good.
Yeah.
I know it's a bold, controversial take.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, that's my thing with Phoenix is it's like, it doesn't take good photos, but they are kind of interesting, I guess. Yes. So I don't know. My problem is I got too excited about it. I bought like six rolls of it. Now I have like four rolls left, and I'm like, what am I gonna use these for? Like, so nothing nice, that matters, obviously, that I want good photos of. But yeah,
the film store, like that store, despite being mostly for digital, does have a little film corner where it's all just like used cameras. They had a couple of cheaper ones.
The corner where the sickos go, basically.
But they do have a pretty good stock of films. I mean, they had all the Fuji ones, pretty much all the Kodak ones. They had Ilford, a couple other, like some of the, they had Cinestill even. Like, they have a pretty good stock there. But I was utterly shocked at how expensive film is nowadays.
Yeah,
A roll of Kodak Gold. I got the 36 shot roll. It was like $25.
I think you're paying. I think you're paying a Bay Area tax. There.
I mean, probably, but still.
Yeah,
Kodak Gold. Let me see what it is on B&H.
Kodak Gold at Glazer's is like $9, $10.
Yeah, it should be about $8 to $10. Yeah.
Well. Yeah, that's the Bay Area.
Maybe don't buy your film from them, but maybe not. ordered from online, or I'll ship it to you.
So. It was just the Kodak Gold though, because the others like Ektar, I paid like $14, which is the same price it is on B&H.
Oh, that's weird.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know what's up with the gold.
That's very weird. Why? Yeah.
And why would you ever buy anything except Ektar? Yeah.
Well.
My stance on this is simply: is there other film? I guess some.
Honestly,
Portra.
I bought it because I haven't shot film since, like, I don't know, when did Kodak Easy Shares become popular? Like 2007? That was the last time I shot film. And I wanted to have something with a lot of shots on the roll to mess up for the first couple of rolls before I use film that I actually like. Because I need that to, like, sense. Relearn how to control the camera. Because I've completely forgotten any of the controls. And I mean, the last film camera I used wasn't even this fancy. It was a Nikkormat from like, I don't know, 78 probably. Mm-hmm. That was what my dad had that I used. So there was all manual controls. It was like, I think it got metering maybe.
Yeah. But
that was it.
Well, this one, you're probably going to be able, you know, if you are okay with doing this, you could just pop it into portrait mode or program mode and let it rip.
No, I've got it in, I put it in aperture priority.
Okay.
Which is fine. Mm-hmm. What I'm regretting now, though, is I had some older F-mount lenses that I had used with my D750, and I got rid of those like 3 years ago, which is a shame because I could use them on this.
Yeah. Oh, well. You live and you learn. This one,
apparently it's a decent bridge camera because it will do metering on some really old lenses in a way that the F, what were they saying? It has a feature that the old lenses use for metering that, like, the F5 and F6 don't.
Oh, is it that little thing on the lens?
Yeah, the little thingy. Yeah. So I can get some really old lenses for this thing and still have metering.
My workhorse film camera is an F4 for the same reason. It's a little flippy tab.
Yeah, my F100 can't do those lenses, but, you know.
The Nikon F4 is the greatest film camera ever made. And it sounds like yours is the second greatest, so good job.
I mean, this one, this is the D7500 equivalent of the, like, D750.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
It was the one step down, the, like, prosumer.
Yeah, you know, F4. the typical product lineup. F, boobs, and then whatever else is going on.
Exactly.
The F5, the N boobs, and then the...
And then the Nyker mat for some reason.
Yeah.
Don't get that one.
Adjusting for inflation, this body was almost $2,000 new.
Holy shit.
Just for the body.
Yeah.
It was $858 at retail in 1988.
How much was the F100 new? Jeez.
Oh boy. Let's see. Nikon F100 price. Well, that is not helpful.
Is that the current price?
Ken Rockwell says he paid $1,400 in 1999.
Okay, so that's going to be a pretty penny these days.
That's not cheap.
Yeah. Well, that makes me feel better about getting mine for like $300.
But this is this article that I read after I picked this up. I didn't really know much about this camera, so I was reading some articles, and this guy is like, he's saying, "Oh, it's great. But it doesn't make me happy because it's too good."
Okay. Okay. Oh my God.
If you want a camera that sucks, like, I can recommend several.
Still, I think he says the last line of the article, "For making art, this ragged old guy will stick to his ragged old camera."
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Cool.
I've noted your opinion.
This is my problem with, like, all of the, like, you know, Phoenix and stuff. Is I'm like, what if the thing was just good? What if I just bought an F4 and put Ektar in it?
Right.
For me, I'm coming from all digital, and, like, I kind of want it to be a little funky.
Here's the thing.
Use Ektar.
Here's the thing. I did two at first because I went, my film photography is very recent. I quit for about probably 12 to 15 years. I'm trying to think, like, by the time I put down that Minolta until picking up I have an F4 and an F, and then I've shot some other stuff. I've got a couple other cameras, but most of what I use is the F4 and the F. And I had like a 10 year gap in there where I just shot digital. And the whole reason I picked up film again is just because I carry around my F4 with me all the time, and I take like one or two pictures a day as I walk. I just see a shot. I'm like, oh, I've got the right lens for it. I'm going to take this photo. I go get it developed, you know, a couple weeks later. I get the pictures back way after that. It feels like, you know, I have enough of the bona fides down now that, like, the pictures usually come out pretty good. And it's just a really nice way to have, like, these good streetscape photos, these good daily life photos that I wouldn't be getting on a digital camera. Because if I take a digital camera out, that's my day.
Sure.
To me. Because there's no limit. There's no, you know, and when I get back home, I'm immediately going to be like, okay, I got to edit these. Because I'm, you know, I probably will take more. Then they're going to require some form of post-processing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just easier to just go shoot film. It's more fun, I think.
So. See, that's how I treat my Fujifilm camera, though. If I want perfect images, I'm going to take my Z9 out and my expensive lenses and get perfect images. But I carry my Fuji around, like, all the time. And I've made a policy for myself that I only shoot JPEG and I don't edit it.
Hmm.
So, but
see, I just read an article about how straight out of the camera is problematic. So,
I mean, I think I get that. I get that a lot. I think the thing for me is like, I want, if straight out of the camera looked like Kodak Ektar, I'd be happy with it. But it doesn't usually. So that's fair. Honestly, I should buy another camera.
The film
but
simulations are really, really just, good.
Just swap it into Velvia mode and let it rip.
I don't think I've only ever used this in Velvia or black and white. That's the only modes I've ever used on this camera.
I had an XC4 and I just left it in Velvia mode to the point where I was like, I'm not really using the film simulations apart from Velvia.
It makes me want them to put the little, they have one that has a tiny little screen on the back that shows the film simulation you're using. Yes, the
X-Pro 3.
Yeah, I want them to put that on all of them or have a mode for it or something.
Yeah. I was looking strongly at an X-Pro 3 this week, but I withheld.
I wouldn't get an X series at this point.
The X-Pro 3 is also like, it came out like 2019. It's due for an update.
It's fairly old. So, and I'm not sure if it'll get an update, honestly. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Victoria, for you, I have there's a friend of mine here who runs a film lab, and he has on the walls, he has like these little collections of all sorts of old film canisters. And one of them that he has is Ektar 1000. And when I saw that, I nearly died because I was like, I need that. Like, can you imagine the images I could take with 1000 speed Ektar? Like,
I would literally die. No, that would be like that. That is, can you imagine? That is my return, right?
Exactly. Like, yes, yes.
Go back to 80s cars that talk to you and give me Ektar 1000, and I will accept any other society.
I need Ektar 1000, and I need Superior 1600. We need better high speed color films. There just aren't very good options.
Nationalize Kodak.
Yeah. I think the time for that is long, long past.
It's too big to fail.
My god. But the other good thing that I got out of this visit to the camera store was the girl there was telling me that there's this guy in San Jose that everyone uses for development, and like all he does is film development, which is
Gotta know the guy. That's the thing. I know the guy. Yeah. Like, this is funny because there's a film lab that does color film like same day, and then there's a camera store that does color film same day. But for any of their other stuff, they send it to this guy and his lab. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to go to him, you know, and like skip the middleman anyway. Right. So also he's very nice, and he now is starting to re-spool like double X so that I don't have to pay Cinestill for it, which is nice.
See, now what I want to do, if I'm going to do this, of course I need to go on Craigslist and find a Nikon CoolScan 3 that only supports SCSI.
Right.
And then I need to go and get a Power Macintosh 9500 and a CRT and everything to be able to really...
Cursed film scanner and...
Yeah. I gotta get the whole kit now.
Right.
I want to scan my film so bad.
I think if you really want to go the extra mile, you need to get one of the Fuji Photo Lab scanners that requires that you have like a particular computer that runs Windows XP to make it work and costs like $4,000, you know.
So somebody on Craigslist
here. Frontier, that's what they are.
Somebody in San Francisco is selling a drum film scanner for $6,000, which actually is a good price.
That's cheap. Holy hell. Wow. All right, let's go. Come on.
Yeah, right. You can donate to our GoFundMe.
And that includes delivery to the Bay Area. So
all right,
it's a deal. This guy's saying that they run it on a G4 Mac with System 9 on it and a USB dongle.
Yeah.
He's probably running it on an iMac or something.
See, this is, I think we should have like collective ownership where someone has a CoolScan 9000, which is the last model they made that can do 120 in addition to 35 millimeter. And then we can just like, you know, ship our film to that person and have them scan it, you know.
That's super CoolScan 9000.
Super, yes. not merely a cool scan, the super cool scan. Yeah.
Well, somebody's selling one on Amazon for $26.99.
Mm-hmm.
It comes with a FireWire cable.
Oh, nice. You do need
my one. Last car cost $600. This is a very fun thing for me to work through mentally.
Yeah. I have a cool scan 4 right here. Yeah. It wasn't that expensive, but this is also not one of the more desirable cool scan models.
Sure.
Because it's not quite as high quality, and also it doesn't do the entire roll at a time scanning that a lot of them do. This one you have to do 6 frames at a time. Unless you're willing to get a Dremel out and chop the back open, I guess. So.
Oh, now hold on. I found a new device.
Oh, dear.
From the Kodak Corporation.
Oh,
available at Target for $34.99.
Do not buy a Kodak branded film scanner.
Kodak mobile slide and film scanner, portable old photo viewer converter. Nice. And what this appears to be is a light box that you put your film strip into. And then you put your phone on top of it, and your phone camera takes a picture of the film.
Okay.
That's what it is. So this is a box for $35.
That's like almost good.
They have Kodak has all-in-one units now for this. Here's one Kodak slide and scan that's all built in for $179. I'm sure that is very good quality.
The lab that I take my stuff to, he has a Kodak F135 scanner, which I had not seen before, but it's an interesting one. I don't know. Does a fine job, I guess. Scanning film is maybe my least favorite part of the film photography process, to be honest.
This is a ridiculous thing to me. A film scanner right now is impossible to buy. But if you want to buy a device that makes Super 8 film into video, you can get those for under $400 new.
Yeah.
But regular photo film? No, get out of here.
Well, I think quality is probably a big factor, right? Because you're not...
yeah.
You're probably also not scanning
the Super 8
in its 4K. Well, that's true. Also, yeah. Bearing the lead a little bit there, I guess.
You can still get slide scanners new.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a mounted 35 millimeter slides, you can get a machine that'll chew through those really quickly.
Well, there are, I mean, you can get like a prime film from Pacific Image. You can get one of those plus techs, but they are not well regarded, I think. And they tend to be somewhat difficult to use. So, many of them require you to like chop the film into, you know, like sets of 6 frames and then put them inside a little carriage or whatever. And it's like, no, I just want to like feed the whole roll in. And like, we had this technology previously, but you know, we've lost it kind of thing.
We need Blackmagic to make one. Cause then it'll actually be good. Yeah. Like they have a film.
Oh,
scanner.
You mean Blackmagic, the company? I thought you were just saying.
No, the Blackmagic Corporation. Yeah. They have a film scanner that'll do 35, Super 35, 16, and Super 16 in HDR 4K. Now that's only $32,000, so
okay,
that'll help you. But honestly, like if they made a film scanner, it would actually be good because they care about this stuff.
This thing is I'm looking at this, the Blackmagic Cintel, and they have a photo of it where it's mounted on the wall like an objet d'art, as it were. Like, who is mounting their film scanner on the wall? Like, yeah, check it out. I mean, this does kind of have like a teenage engineering.
You say that, and then do you think about the audience you have?
Yeah.
Well, you know.
I mean, like, I would.
It looks like a work of art when it's open.
My film scanner.
You've got, this is what Christopher Nolan has one of these mounted on the wall.
Yeah.
My bookshelf is mostly old cameras. Like, this is just going with my decor at this point.
That's true. I have an entire Kallax shelf that's just old cameras. So, yeah. I mean, I've become such a sicko that I bought like an old magazine ad for the F100 so that I can frame it and put it on the wall.
Oh, that kicks ass. If I found like a high-res scan of like an F4 ad, I would absolutely print that.
I've just been looking for them on eBay because people sell them for like $2-3. I've got one for the Minolta X700 and now for the F100. Yeah. Just put Nikon F4 advertisement into eBay and see what happens. The F100 is neat because it says it's got a big photo of the camera that says "Real pros don't fake it."
That's true.
Yeah. Nikon F4 product catalog advertising brochure, 35 pages. That's $15.18 plus $14 shipping from the United Kingdom.
Okay, that's not bad.
Yeah, you can get the whole brochure.
Could.
Yeah. F4 International User's Guide. F90 sales pamphlet. Let me see if they have anything for the boobs camera.
I don't know. How could you make a sales pitch for that?
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, 1988 Nikon N8008 camera print ad ballet dancer mid jump does difficult automatic.
Uh-huh.
No, this is a good one. Okay, so it's a lovely picture of a ballet dancer jumping, and then it says, the difficult, it does automatically. The impossible takes a few more seconds. We used to have good ads, you know, good ad copy.
Have you ever seen the Nikon F4 Have a Shot in Hell ad?
No, I haven't.
No.
Oh my god, it goes insane. It's literally just like little vignettes of like war photographers and, you know, nature, extreme nature shooting in Antarctica like stories. Talking about how the F4 is tough enough that it will out-survive you, basically.
Mm. I mean, I believe it.
That's true.
All right, I put the link to this in the Zencaster chat so you can purchase it. It's only $11.50.
All right.
There you go.
Why not?
Oh no! Wait, there's a 1991 here for the N8008S.
Well, I even have the flash from this ad that came in the kit.
Nice. Those are rare. It's you know, finding old cameras is rare, but finding the accessories from them is even harder. You know,
it's like, it also came with an extra back and an extra focusing screen.
Oh wow! Yeah,
it's got it all.
Because I remember trying to find film magazines for my Pentax 645N, and it was hard to find any that were 120. There's a lot of 220 ones out there because people can't use them anymore. Mm. But finding a 120 film magazine was remarkably difficult. Yeah, I don't know. Make new film cameras, people, and not just Leicas.
Yeah.
Where I'm at.
God,
I don't want to pay $6,000 for a rangefinder 35mm. That's ridiculous to me. You know?
Yeah.
Nikon small lapel pin, Nikon F4, European camera of the year, 89-90. You could put that on I don't know, your camera bag or something.
No, because that'll puncture the waterproofness of my bag. I can't have that.
Yeah, that's true. Compromise the
the integrity of my still suit.
Mm-hmm.
Can't have that.
I did check Victoria into the Minolta Maxim 3 to see what the market thinks about that, and the market does not appear to regard that as a particularly good camera. It's about $30 on eBay for a body. I feel like it deserves a little bit more than that, but, you know, I don't know.
Before I went no contact with my family, I was thinking about asking them to send it to me, but I was like, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
Like, it's not really like a... Like, is it really worth... Like, you can imagine the kind of strained relationship you have with your family if you're, like, thinking about going no contact. So I was like, is it worth calling my mother for a $30 Minolta?
Hey, yeah.
Like, is this the hell I'm going
to
die on?
Before I never speak to you again, you mind sending me that camera?
That I could buy on eBay for $30? Like, one specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the old one. It's in the back of a closet somewhere, you know? Yeah. Just dig it out, send it to me. Very important to me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes.
Oh, no problem at all.
It was a delight. I hope that everybody, you know, enjoyed
it. It was a very good conversation. Yes. And if you want to pre-order Victoria's book, the links for that will be in the show notes, as well as the link to your Patreon. And then where can people find you generally about the internet these days?
I am a writer for motorone.com, so you can read my stories on there if you like cars at all. And I usually try to shoot all my own photos for those. That's can be fun. I have an Instagram page, REIMU racing, all one word, and that's I post there when I remember to. I don't really like Instagram all that much, but it's there.
Yeah.
I have an X.com account. Yeah. You can link to, although I don't really use that all that often anymore now that it's X.com.
Yeah.
I have a Blue Sky. That's my name.
Mm.
If you want to use that, I'm on co-host. People use that.
Yep,
it's kind of tricky because like nobody really uses one site on the internet anymore.
I know.
I have a website.
You can find me scattered across the internet in various atomized spaces.
Yeah, pretty much. Like reading my articles is probably the best thing you can do to keep up with me. Or like I'm going to try to do like book signings and stuff. So I'll post about that when it's going to be like happening. You can just come meet me.
I do recommend following Victoria on Blue Sky because you will get occasional photos of Bert, who is a delight to see at any time.
Oh, yeah. No, I
love Bert.
I mostly have been trying to use all these new social media sites to post pictures of my cat.
Like,
yeah. I mean, that's just what the internet's for.
I mean,
your
really.
Cat who always has a slightly concerned look about him. Gotta say. Like, I feel that I connect with Bert because he looks the way that I feel. Just a slight, like, I don't know about this.
That cat has been moved through 4 states with me.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, I think at this point, he's kind of just, like, a little worried about me, you know?
Yeah.
He's kind of like, hey, Mom, you all right?
Yeah. As for this podcast, you can find us on Instagram and Blue Sky and at censornoise.com. And you can also review the podcast and tell a friend about it if you like it.